I'm Zareen, and I have two questions for you, if I may ask. In a country that has been so oppressed, I would like to understand what gave you the courage and the motivation, and was it your upbringing? Was it something inside you? What helped you be who you are and be able to speak up? And my second question was, what do you see as the outcome of all your efforts that will be realistic outcomes? Are you alleviating suffering as best you can as you see it? Or do you have a plan for transformation? And do you see that in your lifetime?
The first part of your question, I think that the disaster is going on there is enough that our do not let our consciousness that to be silent or sit silent. As right now in front of my people is two ways, sit silent or do a struggle. As we have proudful history, we never accept occupation, and now it became like open secret for these Afghan that our country has been occupied and these terrorist puppets imposed on Afghan. So the support of my people encouraged me. This international solidarity, it gives hope, courage, determination that not sit silent and looking at how I'm walking in the day by day, it proved for me that walking to the right direction. As always, I'm saying to my supporter that what I said, I wish that came wrong, that then I said apologize to my people and supporter around the world. But unfortunately, what I have been seeing coming through at least this 10 years. And also the history, powerful history that we have is enough that to learn from, and especially from the hero and heroine of Afghanistan that we have to follow their path, whom are tied, men and women. Anyway, different reasons that do not let me to sit silence. And as Martin says, there come a time in the history that silence is like betrayal. And also, you said about how it is realistic. You mean that if I do not misunderstand, since I am alive, to see in my life what I'm saying come true, yeah?
And do you have a plan? Do you think it will transform?
Yeah, plan for this, you know, we work for justice together, like network. I'm not alone. Yeah, we are working like in the name of Defense Committee, that we have this network. We are like group working, but like a party, but don't have name. Also, other Democrat parties support us that together as the first demand of people, as I said, is justice. Collecting document of their crimes for the future that not nationally, internationally, bring them to the court. First, we should raise political awareness of these most of non-educated suffer people of Afghanistan. This is the main goal, the main project and plan that we have, and also to make them organize for these goals that we have. It's educationally trying. The education is another plan that I have, the most important, I believe the key. When these people become educated, especially at least this half of population, they never kill themselves when someone rape them or commit crimes against them. These men never go, as some Afghan go with Taliban to take their revenge from the warlords. To go with one terrorist to fight against another terrorist make no sense. So they all have contact with us. As there, I'm working underground with these people, groups and groups of people underground. I meet and then we do the political discussion and working for this cause, justice, execution of these warlords, Taliban, these puppets, these killers, and against occupation, doing organized and open their eyes and working for education. And this list can be prolonged. For this is our plan for the future. Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Hi, Tim Cargan with Veterans for Peace. I had mentioned this to Malalai before this event started. I'm sorry if it already exists. If it does exist, please publicize a central website where we can cut out the middlemen and support different groups and individuals directly. As Malalai's co-author had just mentioned, a lot of the money may be going to people who shouldn't be getting it. And I'd like to think that some of the internet technology may allow some anonymity so that even if people were working underground, maybe they could still get funds. Like one of your assistants said that you can't necessarily publicize someone's name if they're working underground. So maybe there's some way to leverage internet technology to get funds to those folks. Does that have all the different individuals and groups and all their info and the...
No, it just has some groups.
Yeah.
Okay. Another one is Afghan Women's Mission, the co-sponsor of this tour. It's a conduit for funds to Afghan projects. Go ahead.
Yeah, and also these democratic-minded organizations, these social networks, or some democrat NGOs, I mean that honest NGOs and activists. If you want to know about their activism and follow, then there is my email. If you send an email, ask this question, all the their website and their Facebook, all this information I sent you, like this Solidarity Party, like Rawa organization, like social justice seekers, like OPAC, HACA, AFSCO. There is not a number, but more than parties, we have intellectuals in Afghanistan. Their contact is also good to give you, to have link with them, to work together. And this defense committee itself is also like a group. You should encourage them. Most of them volunteer. All of them, I can say they are volunteer and they are working there and active. Yeah.
Thank you.
There's a question for Malala. You said that you see the Taliban and the warlords as a product of the White House. So my question is, in Afghanistan, is there a perception that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden might also have been a CIA fiction from the beginning? Because that opinion is shared by a sizable percentage of the American population. And there's a movement in the country, they call it 9/11 Truth. So I'm curious what your perception of 9/11 Truth is and what the perception of the people of Afghanistan is. Is that a correct way that might be true, or do you think those ideas are wrong-headed?
Yeah, the first part, only the last part of your question I didn't catch, but the first part you said about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. You know, all these terrorists are same. They have links in a way with each other. And these extremist fundamentalists and these terrorists who, especially religious, is a good tool in the hands of them to use it against the people, and they are product of the White House, especially in other Western big powers. And Al-Qaeda, now you see how hypocrite U.S., at least now you see that how in Libya they supported these terrorists, this Al-Qaeda, and against dictator like regime like Gaddafi, removed and brought in power these fundamentalists. In Syria now you are looking how they are giving weapons and arms and support these fundamentalists there. It shows the hypocrisy of the U.S. regime that one day they are their friend, another day they are their enemies. And just when you see their background, all that they created by mainly by U.S. as a superpower. And Osama bin Laden himself, that how you saw that it was, especially for them, a good reason that to occupy Afghanistan with this 9/11 that happened. And then they played this game of Tom and Jerry with Osama and these were Taliban, as they did. And then finally, Osama eliminated by Obama's administration to pretending like a hero. And anyway, as you see that how no difference between the Obama's administration and Bush. Even Obama is, I believe, for this wrong policy that he have in waging the war, is the second and even dangerous Bush. And but for U.S. is very easy to create another Osama for the justification of their criminal war. Let's say like this. Anyway. Mm-hmm. And the godfather of all these terrorists is the U.S. And one day, if it was good for them, for their dirty agendas they have, they say they are their enemies. Another day, they are their friends, just like a family fighting among them, fighting between husband and wife.
My question is a simple one. Have they succeeded in closing the girls' underground schools?
Yeah, you know, education, how much important the government says that, Western media says, Western government, that 6 million girls go to school. And it's a good reason for justification of their occupation. But now there is many reports, even from the ministry office of this puppet regime, hundreds of doors of schools now has been closed for lack of security. Even Taliban in faraway provinces burn the schools and destroy, and even the girls, and when go to school, these warlords in Taliban boot, they threw acids or kidnap or rape. Anyway, education, how much important? It's not in their program that really empower people educationally, especially women. Just they have some project, especially in big cities, for justification of their occupation. Like in Kabul, Herat, Mazar Sharif, you see some women and girls have access to education. But in other provinces, the level of education is very low, even. And even in Kabul, in the University of Kabul, those who graduate, even they, some of them, I see that they cannot write well. And their education, the level is very low. Anyway, and many times the teachers and students, they have strikes, demonstration. For months, they are not receiving their salaries. Even they have some books that they are doing, like brainwash these girls and these boys. Like one gun is equal to two, one gun plus two gun is equal to how many gun? Or one infidel has been killed by one common by one foreigner, and something like this. You know, they are indirectly doing brainwash. The books released by Nebraska. Anyway, many examples like this.
Thank you. What is the most significant humanitarian intervention of the United States? And I would like to say, just to phrase this, I'm taking the chance, that there are also other kind of intervention and other kinds of intervention and manners that can rule, ruin, and destroy a country and its people, such as economic war and economic occupation, which is happening the last 3 years in my country, Greece. Thank you.
Well, I can't really think of the most significant humanitarian intervention, because I can't think of any humanitarian intervention. And it's not just the United States. Try to find one in history. It's not easy. Maybe you can somewhere dig one up. Maybe somewhere you can dig one up, but can you think of one? A genuine humanitarian intervention? I mean, there are interventions that have had a very benign effect. I mentioned two, the two main ones in the post-Second World War period, India and Vietnam. But those don't count. First, of course, we didn't do them, and we opposed them. And again, and if you really look at them, they weren't undertaken with the aim of ending atrocities. They were undertaken for other aims, and they did end massive atrocities. But to find a genuine humanitarian intervention, one taken by a state with the goal of ending atrocities selflessly, see if you can dig one up. Scholarly literature can't.
Hi, I'm Alicia Sanders-Zachary. I'm a student at Tufts University. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on the role of Afghan youth in the progressive movement, and how the movement's reaching out to youth to encourage them to be a part of it.
Yeah, youth, you know that they are the victim of these more than three decades of the war. So more than everyone, they are against the war, and they are active there, fortunately. At least this Democratic Party, I told you, Solidarity Party of Afghanistan, and these social justice seekers, this running by youths there. And their leaders are youth, and their members, most of them are youths, and they are so brave there and active. And there also we see students of the university, when I have meeting underground with them, that how they politically discuss, and always with this question they come, what we can do, how we can bring positive changes, especially this glorious uprising happened that in these countries, Arab countries, even they are following the protests in US and these countries. They are so emotional and happy about this, giving them hope and also they agree with this and following this. And same in their country, they do campaign for this cause. But unfortunately, as I said, those who are in power, it's very risky for them. Most of them have to be underground. But they are active there, and you see at least some of these demonstrations that how they are active, and their eager to education is very a point of hope, very most important point of hope, that how they have eager not only to education, internet is, we live in the century of 21st, that unfortunately they don't have this golden chance that to do campaign for democracy, freedom against occupation. Right now, 2% Afghan, they have access to internet. There is official report. But there we see that how those who have access, they do campaign through these social networks. And if you want, I can give their contact, and you should be stay in contact with them, encourage them more.
Yes, sir. Stan Heller, TSVN. I have a question about the 80s. There are some groups in the United States who claim that when the Soviets were in there, it was a golden age of rights for women. I know Rawa disagrees, and I would like both speakers perhaps to talk about that period.
It was not a golden age for rights for anyone. It was a horror story. But the fact of the matter is that towards the end of the Soviet invasion in Kabul, it was a period in which women had significant rights. Actually, there's several publications about them, about this, by a woman named Rasil Basu. She's a well-known international feminist figure. She's one of the people who founded the International Rights of Women Day in 1974. And she was the UN ambassador to Afghanistan with special concern for the rights of women in the last years of the late 1980s. And she wrote several articles which were quite interesting. She's a very sensible person. She certainly didn't claim it was a paradise, anything like that. But, well, you can talk about it better than I can, but she described pretty high degree of freedom for a segment of educated, relatively privileged women at the universities who did face dangers, but the dangers they faced were people like Gulbuddin Matyar, the U.S. favorite, throwing acid in the faces of women who were not, they said, weren't dressed properly. She has several interesting articles about it. You can find them with some effort. She submitted the articles to the U.S. press. They refused to publish them, the mainstream media. She submitted the articles to Ms. Magazine, the feminist magazine. They refused to publish it because you're not supposed to say that. So she ended up publishing them in, I think it was in Asia Times, an India-based journal. But you can find them. So that did exist, but it certainly wasn't a golden age for women or anyone else. It was a horror story.
I think I already answered your question. During my speech and also the slide also was enough that I think maybe you were not on that time. Anyway, but you want me to give more example of this?
Well, I know that Rawa was against the Soviet occupation, even though there may have been some positive aspects for women.
Oh, you're asking about Soviet time, yeah. Regarding, Soviet time. Oh, sorry, I misunderstood the question. Anyway, but you know, Soviet, when the role of the Soviet, when you compare with the role of the fundamentalists when they were in power in Taliban and even this 12 years of occupation, these two, when you compare, we have that, how to explain this in English to you, that time was better than this time when you compare, like between bad and worse. That is bad and this is worse, you know? Like this, I hope you understand what I say. But they committed crimes under the name of socialism. They did. They have nice banner like good food for people, good house, blah, blah. And but like now, USA, they have good banner like women rights, human rights, like this. But regarding the woman, especially the woman situation you asked was, you even cannot compare with this extremist fundamentalist warlords in Taliban. But they have many things in common. Like both, they are also puppets. Taliban and warlords also puppet. They were on that time, they committed crimes under the name of secularism, and now they are talking about Islam, this puppet of Russia. The difference was that, like these warlords and Taliban did massacre without making list of the people. They did massacre in Policherchy jail with the list, as one list of their crimes I said now released. Regarding the women, for example, on that time, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar party, these extremist fundamentalists, they threw the seats, as Professor Noam Chomsky also said about this. There was happening some examples that as a beginning, but the policy that they had was wrong. For example, most people are, one example I'm giving you, that most people are Muslim. This is Muslim country, but they were pretending like to do couple when they marry, if to bring mullah, it is religious. No need to bring mullah, no need to be nikah, something like this. And they were organizing such kind of marriage party. And it was too much for the people, for this Muslim people. It like to impose on someone to wear a scarf or not wear a scarf, you know? Like they were doing like not wear a scarf. Many examples like this, but no question that they were progressive, they were intellectual. When you compare with the Taliban and warlord, the puppet of Russia, they call themselves, we are communists, we are socialists, but they killed countless, hundreds and hundreds of those who were socialists, those who were communists. Same like their ideology, but they were not puppet. And they just eliminated them. And regarding the women also, that those women who were activist women, those who were against the role of them, it was easy for them to eliminate or have to leave. Or to be silent, yeah, otherwise they killed them. Yeah.
Yes.
Hi.
One sentence I want to add. And now also that they are part of this regime, especially they are running the intelligence service in Afghanistan. As they are intellectuals, I can't say intellectual, how I should say so-called intellectual. I mean that educated one, and they running this intelligence service, and because these warlords and Taliban are so stupid and not educated. Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you all for coming. It's been a pleasure listening to you all speak. My question is related to, you referenced the U.S. troops, the source of the problem being U.S. troops still in Afghanistan. My question relates to, U.S. troops left Iraq officially about 2 years ago. My question is, why did the U.S. decide to withdraw from Iraq, for instance, or earlier? There's still, the U.S. Has not withdrawn from Afghanistan completely. What's the motivation for keeping troops there? Do you believe President Obama when he says he really wants to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan? And what's preventing that from happening?
I will answer this, then Professor Chomsky also can answer this question. In Iraq, it is true that they apparently they left Iraq, but their puppet regime remained there. And what they did in Iraq alone is unforgivable and unforgettable, U.S. And same like what they did in Iraq, they occupied Iraq because of the island of Iraq, and now indirectly they interfered there and they have their own puppet regime there. And still continue their barbarism in different way. Same now in Afghanistan, as now it become like open secret for them, this endless disgusting war. They are making more powerful their puppet regime by bringing Taliban also in power, make more unite these killers, and also expanding their military bases. They are going to legalize their military bases, and they have countless secret military bases to continue to their barbarism again. And then a few thousands of the troops leave, but they remain their bases and their puppet regime. Then same like what they did in Iraq, they control. And as Professor Chomsky said regarding the Iraq embassy of Iraq, if I'm not wrong, that you said like city within a city, a huge city within a city, I read. Yeah, according embassy of US. It is exactly same like in Afghanistan. and many things we have in common. But in Afghanistan, why they choose in Afghanistan? Because of the geopolitical location of Afghanistan. We are in the heart of Asia. There's many reasons they don't want, and they will never leave voluntarily Afghanistan. First, through Afghanistan control these Asian powers, China, Russia, etc., and have easily access to the gas and oil of the Central Asian republics. Especially they are working on the project of the pipeline, going to finish it by support of their puppets. And also they are receiving billions of dollars from opium industry, as after oil and gun, trade of oil and gun, they are making a lot of money from this dirty business of opium. And also they are looting our rich resource that there we have, as our copper mine is the second best copper mine in the world. And we have uranium, lithium, blah, blah. And many examples like this that they, these are the reasons, main reasons that they never leave Afghanistan voluntarily. Yeah, and Professor Chomsky, do you want?
Just add a word about Iraq. The United States had no intention of leaving Iraq. They were forced to. Iraq was a total defeat, extreme defeat for the United States. If you want to check it, take a look at the, there was an official declaration of the Bush administration in November 2007, it's right toward the end, in which they, the administration stated its long-term goals for Iraq. There were two conditions. One was that the U.S. have military bases in Iraq, which it can continue to use for combat operations and, of course, for its position in the Middle East. The second was that U.S. corporations must be privileged in their access to Iraqi resources, meaning oil. That was November 2007. In January 2008, that was reinforced by one of these famous signing statements. You know, when the president has to sign a legislation, but he adds, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to live up to it. It's called a signing statement. In January 2008, there was such legislation, appropriations legislation, and Bush and his, whoever writes his comments for him, added that a signing statement saying that they would not sign anything that restricted these two objectives. That was January 2008. They couldn't get away with it. The Iraqis refused. Iraqi nationalism was strong enough to prevent the U.S. from carrying forward these intentions. So Bush had to start the withdrawal process. Obama's just continued Bush's program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your talk. It was very, it was great. I have two questions, one from Malala, one from Professor Chomsky. Malala, there are countries that never recover, and the destruction, the chaos, even the infrastructure becomes so damaged that the country never comes back. And I will give an example of Haiti today. Given the circumstances and the current situation of your country, do you think that is there still a hope of the country recovering once the United States leaves and the country becomes again its own, which is handling his own business, that the tools are still there and the structure is still there to the country come back? And I'm going to ask Professor Chomsky now. Puerto Rico has been part of the United States since the Spanish-American War. My country, Dominican Republic, has been invaded twice by the United States. And even last year, the United States said that there is an island out of the coast of the South that they want to put a military base for the sake of protecting the country against drug trafficking. That's a natural oasis for many birds that fly from Florida to the corner of the island. Now, my question for you is the following. For a country that can not even agree on a budget, for a country that is clearly divided in opinion, whether it's the general media, whether it's the left media, right media, doesn't matter, I see that the war machinery is still intact. They cannot agree on on general regular things, but when it comes to war, invasions, putting military bases, how and why do this happens?
What country?
Dominican Republic.
So why are their bases established?
Yeah, and why is the military war strategy intact?
Why does the U.S. military want the bases?
How does this keep happening, even in a country that is in so much disarray economically right now, and they're still expanding everywhere, and who controls that, where it comes from? For a country in Congress, they cannot even agree on a budget.
That's what it means to run the world.
It's simply power and violence. Dominican Republic's a perfectly good example. Woodrow Wilson invaded the Dominican Republic, they half destroyed it, they did even a more monstrous attack on the other half of Hispaniola, Haiti. The Dominican Republic supported dictatorships, Trujillo, you know, a whole series of dictatorships. 1965, it looked as if there was going to be an independence movement in Dominican Republic. Johnson sent the troops and put that one down, and so it continued. It's simply violence. Why, do you know any other country in the world that has 800 military bases around the world? Nobody else has the power to do it. I mean, France has about 2, I think. Britain doesn't have any anymore. The United States has maybe 800, maybe 1,000. That's what power is. And the countries that don't want it are treated like the Dominican Republic. They're invaded. Or the government's overthrown, you know. Well, right now, first of all, the government generally functions reasonably well. Right now, there is a serious problem. The government is not functioning. But that's something pretty special in the last roughly 10 years. What's happened in the United States, and this has not affected the military. They, if you notice, are still getting funded and so on. What's happened in, generally speaking, in the United States, last generation, is that there have been significant economic changes. So the economy's moved towards financialization, destruction of the productive part of the economy. It's still there, but it's offshore, you know, Bangladesh, China, you know, and so on. So there's a exportation of production, financialization of the economy. It's led to very sharp concentration of wealth, as you know, and stagnation for most of the population. This is the concentration of wealth leads to concentration of political power automatically, which keeps the vicious cycle going because of new legislation, deregulation, and so on. All of this has led to a situation, and meanwhile, the cost of elections has skyrocketed, not just presidential, congressional, everything. The net effect is that power is very heavily concentrated in a tiny group, which is pretty far to the right. If you go back 30 or 40 years, there was a kind of a standard quip, which was sort of accurate, that the United States is a one-party state, the business party, with two factions. And now it's a one-party state with one faction, and it's not Democrats. It's moderate Republicans who call themselves Democrats. The Democratic Party shifted so far to the right that it's kind of like what moderate Republicans were a generation ago. The Republican Party has gone off the spectrum. There's nothing like it in any parliamentary system. They have so dedicated themselves to the ultra-rich and the corporate sector that they can't get votes. And in order to get votes, they've had to mobilize sectors of the population which have been around, but were never a political force before. So the religious right, for example, it's a huge sector in the United States. Nativists who want to keep everybody out because they've taken everyone's thing away from us. It's a very frightened country, it always has been. So people who are afraid they've got to have guns to defend themselves from the UN or the federal government or whatever. These sectors of the population have been mobilized. The Republican establishment is trying to control them, and it can't. That's what's happening in Washington now. This is not just, you know, this opinion is expressed by the most respected conservative figures. I mean, the most respected conservative political analyst in the country is Norman Ornstein, American Enterprise Institute, you know, a very right-wing institute. And he simply describes the new Republican Party as what he calls a radical insurgency, which has no interest in parliamentary politics, won't accept science, won't accept anything. They just have their own fanatic beliefs. If somebody says there's global warming, you get somebody on Fox News saying we'll leave it in the hands of the deity. You know, that's what's going on. So yes, under those conditions, the government is dysfunctional. But that hasn't, it's not what has happened with, it's not what's happened in the past, and it's not, plenty of things wrong, but not that. And it's, it hasn't affected, maybe it will affect the military, but it hasn't so far. And it certainly hasn't throughout this whole period when the military system expanded all over the world. And in fact, right now, the U.S. is expanding its military base system quite extensively. So for example, Africa is being saturated with what will become, already partially are, but will become military bases. So it continues. But the dysfunction is real, and it's due to a sharp drift to the right in the whole mainstream society, the establishment, the economy, the social system, the political system, and so on. I mean, somebody like, say, Richard Nixon today would be way out on the left. In fact, Congress today is trying to dismantle Nixon's relatively progressive accomplishments. That's what's happened to the country. It's an international scandal.
According to your question, you know, as always I say, if US and NATO, these foreigners, let us to breathe a little bit in peace. If they leave us alone, then I'm sure my people, even with empty hands, they will build their countries. But unfortunately, the interfere of these foreigners, they still, and not only that they are there for their own interest and they have these different kind of dirty agendas as this one dirty British policy nowadays, they are playing dividing role there in Afghanistan. Even they are, we are very worried about the division of Afghanistan. You are talking about reconstruction of Afghanistan. While a US senator says once that the only solution of Afghanistan is the federalism. Federalism, you know, division. And also our British politician says publicly that the Afghanistan solution is division. And anyway, and nowadays there are a group of warlords going to Germany. There are these wrong politicians organized for them big expensive conferences and they say the solution is federalism. And as publicly they are talking, we are really worried about this division of our country. But while you say reconstruction, it is so easy. No question that we need a helping hand while we want the withdrawal of the troops, international solidarity of justice-loving people around the world, morally and financially, especially educationally, they should support our people. And this project that we have for education, reconstruction of Afghanistan, women rights, etc. Anyway, but you mentioned the example of Haiti. Let me give you the example of Sierra Leone. Look, in Sierra Leone, they are the most diamond of the world is there. If I pronounce correct, Sierra Leone. You know Sierra Leone? Sierra Leone. This African country, Sierra Leone. Where is the most diamond of the world is there?
Sierra Leone.
Yeah, Sierra Leone. Yeah, but the most poor people is living there. Afghanistan is the second one, like the second Sierra Leone. And Haiti and many other countries, when you see in a way in the behind of this, all these miseries and all these wars going on there for endless time, is the hand of these foreigners for their own interests. And just I wanted, regarding the question before our one of our supporters asked that according Russia puppet, I want to tell you that in point of view of my people, this puppet of Russia is They have the responsibility of the beginning of this disgusting war in Afghanistan. As during the Cold War, they created this kind of situation, opportunity for the US to create these fundamentalist extremists that give them weapons, empower them, and then they come in power the civil war. Their responsibility is more, they are more criminal. They are, the people want as now and always the public prosecution of them. And they say they have the responsibility of the starting of this disgusting war in Afghanistan. And secondly, two times they committed crimes. Once in the past, as I said, in the name of socialism, when they were in power, committed crimes. And now, with nice banner of the US, joined the hands with extremist fundamentalists to get a continuity to their fascism. So they are, I don't know how to, and who, did you got what I mean? Yeah. Anyway, I'm wondering about my English. That's why I'm, as I wish I can't explain sometime.
Well, I feel honored to have attended this extraordinary meeting for both Professor Chomsky and Malala. You are an extraordinary young woman, and we have a lot of faith on you. My question to Professor Chomsky is, given your description of this country, how long do you think the majority of Americans is going to take it? How are they going to cope with all these injustices that are happening in the country? And to Malala, do you feel that your life is in danger when you go back to Afghanistan? What are you going to do to protect yourself? And then, are you running for office? Or do you think that there is another means to transform your country?
There's no answer to that question. Depends how much we can achieve. I mean, take things that have been achieved, okay, and ask how long it took. So for example, the two original sins of the country were slavery and extermination of the indigenous population. How long has it taken for those to be overcome? Well, the indigenous population is virtually destroyed. I mean, they kind of survive, but under horrible conditions. Slavery is technically overcome, but other devices were quickly created which reinstated a version of slavery. I won't go through the history, but it happened in 1877, 10 years after the Civil War, effectively criminalizing black life, which sent black males into prisons where they became essentially a slave labor force. Now that changed that went on until the Second World War. Then there was a period in which of economic growth and which substantial part of the black population could drift into the society. Finally, in the mid-60s, there was successful civil rights legislation. But we're now back in a period roughly like the late 19th century, with the black population criminalized, especially black males, under the totally fraudulent drug war, and being driven back into the prisons. So there's been progress, but it's not over, and that's 400. The first slaves came in 1620. It's a long time. Let's take something which has a little more progress. Women's rights. How long did that take? You go back to the revolutionary period. Women were not persons. They were property. The founders of the country took over British common law under which a woman was the property of her father transferred to her husband. One of the arguments against allowing women to vote in the early days of the Republic was that it would be unfair to unmarried men, because a married man would have two votes, because obviously the property votes the way its owner does. How long did that last? Well, you know, it wasn't until 1975 that women were accepted legally as peers in federal juries. Women had no legal right to serve in a federal jury. You're supposed to be tried by a jury of your peers. But women didn't have that status until 1975. That's a pretty long time. It's changed, a substantial change. Country's not like what it was 50 years ago, but you could never have predicted how long it was going to take. How long it was going to take depended on how much effort and energy and dedication and commitment would be put into changing it. And it's the same today.
I come from Afghanistan and will go back too. As it's part of my struggle that traveling and attending and conferences that support us, this freedom-loving people of these countries invite me, and to bring the message of my people, to talk about realities of this so-called war on terror and these fundamentalists, brutalities of these fundamentalists, and asking for international solidarity. Because otherwise we will leave all these tribune to these so-called Democrat women or men that who are traveling a lot and deceiving good people around the world. And from this fame I want to use for the good cause for my people. And support that they invite in different countries, that's the reason I'm coming. And of course there is a risk, and I accepted this risk, and I'm not better than my people. And we do struggle together for bringing peace, democracy, women rights, these values in our country, and to do struggle against the occupation. And second part of your question that an election, if I run, this previous elections, people called me to run. I did boycott, same for presidential election. Even people don't see the number of my age. Well, because of my age, even I want, I can't attend in this election, presidential election, because must be 40 years old. Anyway, but we experienced this fraudulent, ridiculous election in our country, especially for someone like me. If run for the election, it is clear, not possible, especially this time, to win. As they saw that what I did in the parliament, I exposed their mask through Tribune of Parliament, I did not sit silent. And they know that, again, if I go to parliament, I will be the same person. As again, I believe even that parliament will be more mafia parliament than the previous one, as we experience. Anyway, that's what I did about election, to be a political awareness, a chance for political awareness to the people that why I did boycott. Like millions of other Afghans, they boycott this election now, and they do not run. And the person will be winner, who will sign the selling of Afghanistan. I mean that to their godfather, to be puppet of the US. That will be the winner of this election. Like our people use this proverb that the donkey will be same, but only saddle will change. That will be the result, yeah.
I would like to thank Malala Joya and Noam Chomsky for their talk this evening.
Noam Chomsky and Malala Joya speaking at the Unitarian Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts on October 8th. This program was recorded by Chuck Rosina for the Boston Community Radio Project. Thanks for listening.